This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello and welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm talking to Courtney Norbury, Professor of Developmental Language and Communication Disorders at Psychology and Language Sciences, University College London, and Director of the Literacy, Language and Communication Lab. Professor Courtney Norbury has written a topic guide for ACAM on developmental language disorders. Developmental language disorder, DLD, is diagnosed when a child's language skills are persistently below the level expected for their age. Professor Courtney will be giving us an overview of developmental language disorder during this podcast. Courtney, hello. Can you start by introducing yourself with a few details about your role?
Yes, and thank you for inviting me to join this podcast. So I'm a professor at UCL, so a lot of my time is spent teaching undergraduate students, but I also direct the LILAC lab, and I'm the principal investigator for the SCALES study, which stands for Surrey Communication and Language in Education Study, and has been a population study exploring language development and disorder from school entry throughout the first few years of primary school.
Okay, great. And perhaps you can tell us a bit more about that a bit later on. Can you tell me how you became interested in this particular field?
Sure. I think I've always had an interest in language and how people learn language and how languages differ. And when I was a teenager, I used to work with a little boy who had a very severe language disorder. And I guess I became quite sensitive to how important language is for pretty much every aspect of your daily life. And so because of that, I trained to become a speech and language therapist, and I worked clinically for a few years. And I think I just started to think that maybe if we knew more about the disorder and why children had it and how it manifested, we could tailor our interventions in a more effective way. And so that really took me down the research route. And I just find it so exciting that that's pretty much where I've stayed.
Right. Just taking a step back, we're going to talk in detail about DLD, but I think it would be helpful if you could start by giving a sort of basic summary of what developmental language disorder is.
Sure. So DLD is diagnosed when a child's language skills are behind what we would expect for their given age. And so generally what you'll find is a child who might not talk so much. And when they do say something, it sounds very immature. So they'll use very short sentences. They might make errors in what they say. So they might say, "him walk to school yesterday." So they leave endings off words, or they exchange words. They might not have very specific words to explain things. So it can be quite confusing to understand what they're trying to communicate. And often they'll have trouble understanding what other people say as well. So if you give them an instruction that says, "go upstairs, brush your teeth and bring your shoes down," they might get upstairs and then look at you and can't remember what happened next. So they have trouble understanding and remembering language, but what you'll notice is the trouble they have expressing themselves.
What would be the typical age for that to be noticed?
So usually it's a developmental disorder, which means that people will see children struggling to learn language very early on, almost from the word go. It's a little bit complicated though, because early in development, there's lots of natural variation. So deciding what's natural variation from a problem before the age of 3 or 4 can be really challenging. But once children get to school, then it's very obvious that they're having trouble with language and that's preventing them from succeeding in everyday school life with their peers, etc. So I would say that DLD really is about persistent language difficulties. And for that reason, you would tend to have a diagnosis from about the age of 4 going forwards. But parents particularly will probably notice some challenges with language development before that point.
And just to clarify, this is oral language. This is not written language. So say differentiate between a child that's got dyslexia, for example.
So it is oral language, but of course, written language is built on a foundation of good oral language. So very often children with DLD will also have problems with reading and writing because that's written language. And the problem is not just with the apparatus for speaking, but it's with the whole conceptual development of language itself. So for very young children, you'll notice that they're not talking or not talking sufficiently as you would expect for their age. But as they get older, those problems will be seen both in what they say, but also in their written language as well.
Right. I know the exact causes of DLD are not known, but can you say anything about the current thinking about the causes?
Yes, and actually our thinking about the causes of DLD has changed quite dramatically in the last 30 years or so. So through really clever studies that use twins in the design, we know that language disorders have a biological basis, so they're genetic influences on language disorder, but we don't understand those terribly well. So like other neurodevelopmental conditions, our thinking at the moment is that there are lots of genes and lots of genetic variants that affect the way the brain develops, each of them having some kind of small influence, and together they increase the risk that somebody will have problems with language. So we know there are genetic factors involved, and we know that they're involved with how the brain develops. So a while ago, we would think that language disorder in many ways resembles the sorts of language problems that adults have when they have a stroke. So we were thinking maybe it's something to do with specific regions of the brain, particularly in the left hemisphere. But we now know that that's probably not the case. It's not a specific area of the brain that's affected, but rather how the whole brain is developing, and particularly connections between the brain. So I think it's really important to highlight that it is a biologically based disorder, because of course, very often what we'll think is that, well, these children just aren't getting a lot of talk at home, or maybe they're watching too much TV, and that's why their language isn't developing. But actually, we have pretty strong evidence that DLD has a biological basis, and that has to do with how the brain is developing and the implications of that for language learning.
That's probably helpful for parents to know, I would have thought.
I think so, yes.
How common is developmental language disorder?
It's very common, actually. So in our scale study, we asked this question specifically, and we looked at all the children in year one and gave them quite a comprehensive assessment. And what we found was that 7.5% of children had language deficits that weren't attributed to any other developmental condition. So those would be children with DLD. And 7.5% roughly translates to two children in every year one classroom. So it's very common, and teachers very likely have children with DLD in their classrooms.
It's quite sizable.
It is, and you think 7% is considerably more than the prevalence rate for autism. And it's broadly in line with other developmental conditions like ADHD and dyslexia.
Right. My understanding is that developmental language disorder rarely occurs in isolation. What other conditions often accompany this?
That's a great question. So if you take what we know about cause, that there's something not developing, your brain is not developing appropriately, it's not surprising then that other things are going to be associated with problems with learning language. The very common ones, as I said, are about literacy. So because reading has a foundation of oral language, most children with DLD will have problems with literacy development. Motor skills are often impaired as well. So children might seem a little bit more uncoordinated or clumsy. Children very often have attention deficits, usually inattention. And again, understanding the cause is very difficult. It could be this underlying biological basis that is contributing to both. But if you think about it, if you're not understanding what's going on in the classroom, it can be hard to pay attention for long periods of time. And also, language is a really good problem-solving tool. So what we tend to see is that children who have more severe language disorder also tend to score more poorly on nonverbal tasks, because even though they don't require a verbal response, we often internalize our language to help us figure out things that are hard. So very often those children might have more general cognitive difficulties, although they don't have intellectual disorder as such. So they can be a real mixed bag, and it's important to think about that, because sometimes those other problems will mask the language difficulty.
I wanted to ask you that. So does the fact that a child with developmental language disorder may have other co-occurring conditions, does that make it harder to identify DLD, or does it mean that it gets missed or misdiagnosed?
Absolutely. So in our study, what we found was when you ask teachers about children's performance, they're very good at picking up the children who are having trouble learning in the classroom, children who have reading problems, children who have behavior problems, but very often they don't think that this might be an underlying language problem. So children with DLD might get labeled as naughty because they're not following directions, or sometimes people will think that they're just not that bright because they're not doing the work properly, when actually what's happening is there's a language disorder that underpins these things. So one of the reasons that I'm delighted that there's a topic paper on this for ACAM is to make people realize that if children are presenting with behavior problems or attention problems or learning problems, that it's worth considering what their underlying language skills are like.
And who normally picks up the fact that there's a problem? Will it be the teachers or the parents or health professionals?
Well, I think it's really important that we all have an eye on this. So with very young children, parents will notice if they're not talking or not responding. But of course, some parents, and particularly new parents, might not really know what to expect at different ages. So they might think, oh, it will just get better over time, or it will change when they go to school. So they might be aware that something's not quite right, but they might not be thinking this is a language disorder. Now, teachers have a really big role in picking this up. And like I said, sometimes that's difficult because of the other things that the child might be presenting with. But teachers are very good at recognizing children who are having difficulties in the classroom. And I think more and more they have a willingness to, with parents, refer on to a speech and language therapist. Sometimes health visitors will pick it up. So particularly in young children, you know, we have developmental checks, and language is always one thing that they're asking about. So what are the children saying? What are their understanding is like? So that can be really important. We have been doing a lot of raising awareness with general practitioners. So if a parent were to go to the GP and say, oh, my child's not saying very much, we're hoping that they will have a greater awareness of DLD. So they will think, maybe we should check that out. And then finally, it's really important for CAMS teams to understand developmental language disorder. There's a team in Canada a few years ago who showed that about a third of referrals to tertiary child and adolescent mental health services had undiagnosed language problems. And if you think about the sorts of interventions we might put in place for children who need CAM support, a lot of them are talking therapies. So I think for those professionals to really be thinking, what are the language needs that this child has and how can we accommodate them, is really important.
Right. So that's a really good point. They could be well-meaning, but actually it's just not going to help.
Yes. Yes.
So let's suppose somebody, a parent, a teacher, a health professional suspects DLD. What are the next steps in terms of diagnosis and assessment and so on?
Yes. So hopefully professionals will will refer children, or parents will refer children that they're concerned about, to speech and language therapy services. The speech and language therapists are specifically trained to assess children's speech, language, and communication. And they'll do that using parent interviews, so they get a sense of the child's developmental history and what their everyday use of language is like. And they'll also use standardized tests. So for most tests, we have a very good idea of what children should be doing at different ages. So we might look at their vocabulary, so how many words they know and what they know about those words. We might look at their grammar, so we could ask them to produce sentences or repeat sentences that get longer and more complex. And then we'll look at their language in longer context, so storytelling or in conversation, where they've got to interact with other people. And you would look both at what they're able to produce and also what they're able to understand. And then we also want to know what the functional impact is. So if a child is having difficulty with language, how is that affecting their peer relationships? How is that affecting their ability to learn? How is it affecting their ability to cope in everyday situations? And so speech and language therapists would be very key to saying, yes, this child is having problems with language that are out of keeping with our expectations for age. Sometimes, though, you need a multidisciplinary team to think about differential diagnosis, because, of course, language problems are associated with a whole range of developmental conditions, autism being a really good example, where many children who have autism conditions will also have problems with language and communication. So it's important that other members of the health team can have a look and make sure that we've got the diagnosis right.
So if a diagnosis is made of DLD, what then happens in terms of treatments and interventions? Can you talk a little bit about what's known to be successful?
Yes. So there's lots of different approaches that people will use. And unfortunately, in the UK, as in many other countries, it varies quite a lot depending both on where you are and what age the child is. So for children who haven't gone to school yet, very often parents will be involved in the intervention. So the idea will be that, you know, having a child who isn't communicating properly makes parents behave in different ways because parents really want them to start talking. So very often what therapists will do is video parents and children together and coach parents to not always change, but just modify some of their communication to really support children. So it might be things like don't ask questions, but just comment on what the child is doing. Simplify what you're saying. Just techniques like that. And thinking about ways that you can increase parent talk in everyday situations.
So it's important to involve the whole family in the intervention.
Absolutely. Well, parents are certainly key. They don't cause language disorders, but they're certainly key in supporting children's communication. And we know from studies of typical development that parent talk is highly predictive of child language. So we really want to try to get to help parents to maximize communication and also to recognize sometimes kids might be doing things non-verbally that are communicative attempts. So because we're expecting language, we might miss some of those things. So it's really recognizing that when a child is trying to use a gesture or pointing or looking at something, that they might be trying to communicate. And what parents can do is put language on top of that so children have a good model of what they could say. Speech therapists always also working with nursery staff. Children go to nursery, go to daycare, and those staff have a critical role too in helping children's language development through shared book reading and through play particularly. So they might be working with school staff to facilitate language in those contexts. Once children get to school, then again, any intervention is going to have to involve the key players in that child's life. So there's a lot of work on working with teachers and training teachers in what sorts of language is important for accessing the curriculum, how you can teach tricky words or grammatical structures that are going to really help with learning. And then for children who have really significant deficits, speech and language therapists might also be involved in more targeted or specialist interventions. So for example, a teaching assistant in a school might run small groups that have a more specific focus on certain types of language for learning. Or the speech and language therapist might see children individually, both to work on specific language targets, but also maybe to give children strategies. For example, recognizing when they don't understand something and feeling confident to put their hand up and say, could you say that again? Or I don't know what that word means. Or maybe sometimes thinking about other alternative means, like using symbols or maybe signs to help with communication when it's particularly hard.
Right. And what evidence is there to vouch for the efficacy of these type of interventions and techniques?
Well, this is one of the things that's most exciting at the moment. There are more and more studies all the time and more robust studies. So we're learning a lot more about what we need to do. What the evidence at the moment tells us is that interventions can be very effective in changing particular language targets. So, for example, if I wanted to extend children's utterances or get them to use particular grammatical constructions like a passive, the ball was kicked by John or something like that, we can do that pretty effectively. It takes time, but you can do that. What seems to be much harder is improving somebody's overall understanding of language, or having a small change have a bigger systemic change in the language system. So I think what we used to hope is that by having speech and language therapy, we might be able to normalize children's language. And I think what we're beginning to recognize is that, like in many other developmental disorders, you can't cure the condition, but you can improve aspects of language or behavior that will help children to cope better with the difficulties that they have.
Right. And what are the long-term prospects then for a child with developmental language disorder if they get this good support?
Well, the good support is absolutely key. In the studies, there are a few studies that have followed children with language disorder into adulthood, and the outcomes are really variable. So some children with language disorder do actually really well. You know, they go to college, they get jobs, they get married, they're very happy. And that's great. If they don't get such good support, then certainly children with language disorders are at higher risk for a number of adverse outcomes. So as a group, they tend to not have as many school qualifications when they leave. They tend not to go on to higher education. They tend to have more difficulties with employment, so finding jobs and keeping jobs. And even when they get jobs, they tend to be more manual type labor. And that's not surprising when you think about what language disorder does. So it makes it more difficult to read, more difficult to learn. You think about job interviews, that's completely terrifying for most of us. But if you don't understand questions and you have trouble formulating answers, it's a particularly big barrier to overcome. We also know that language is hugely important for social relationships. So very often as children get older, it becomes harder to develop good, close social relationships and friendships. There's often misunderstandings. They may feel socially isolated. And we know that children with language disorders are at increased risk for some adverse mental health outcomes at about the rate of twice that you would expect to see in children who don't have language disorders. So although most of them will have very positive outcomes, there is the risk of all of these negative things. And that's why supporting children throughout their school careers, and particularly in that transition to adolescence and early adulthood, is absolutely critical.
Right. So what would you like to see happen to improve the prospects of people with DLD?
That's a great question. So I think there's a number of strands that are particularly important. One is raising awareness. So adults with DLD will say, you know, if I were to tell somebody I had DLD, nobody would know what that means. Whereas an individual with autism could say, I have autism. And most people would at least be able to orient themselves to, oh, okay, that means we might have some challenges with this, but you might have some strengths with that. So I think just raising general awareness is a very important thing to do, so that if a young person were to say to somebody at a train station, I have DLD, they might be able to then adapt their communication to help them understand what they need to do in that situation. Or indeed, if you're going to a GP and you say, I have DLD, that would alert them to think about how they're explaining their health information in that particular context. So raising general awareness, I think, is really important. I think there's a recognition that teachers are really key in this whole process of learning and support, and to enhance teacher training to give them more information and more strategies for supporting children with language disorders and other developmental conditions as well. Giving them some more tools to support language disorder in the classroom, I think, would be hugely beneficial. And then in terms of our speech and language therapy provision, we rightly emphasize the importance of early intervention, and it is good to get in early to support people and to prevent some adverse consequences. But what you see now is that that support really drops off after primary school. And yet we know those children don't get magically cured. So they're going to secondary school with language difficulties, and the nature of the language you need in secondary school becomes far more complex. The nature of social relationships becomes more challenging as well. So what I'd really like to see is a kind of rebalancing, so that we do have early support available, but we also have continued support and more research into what those adolescents with language disorder need and how we can best support them.
Right. And at the moment, from what you're saying, you don't just have to be a specialist in language to be able to help people in this situation. But where do people go at the moment, teachers, parents and GPs, to get skilled in this area? Do these resources exist at the moment?
So there is lots of support available. And I think if any professional wanted to get more support, then the first port of call could be their local speech and language therapy services, or they could get in touch with the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapists. There's a lot of training that these specialist SLTs provide to all kinds of user groups. And it's really on the agenda that we do want to train the children's workforce to be able to support children with language disorder. I think it's useful to think about it in the sense that we might think about childhood obesity. You know, it's something that everybody can contribute to, but their contribution might be slightly different. So parents have a big role in helping children to eat healthy food and to get exercise. Similarly, for language disorder, parents have a huge role in talking to their children and in putting strategies in place to facilitate communication. Same at school. So you don't have to be a specialist to support children. Everybody needs to be aware of what language disorder is and to have some strategies for supporting children who are struggling. But we always need those specialist services to come in and provide an individualized package of support for particular children.
Right. At the very start, you touched upon your research. Can you say a little bit more about the latest research and what you're doing that excites you?
Well, I think it's a really exciting time to be involved in research in language disorder. So our research is a big population study. We've been looking at change in language over time. And in this current wave of data collection, our children are now in year 6, and we've just finished seeing them in year 6, and we're going to see them again in year 8. So we're going to be looking at changes in language during adolescence, but also the impact of language and language disorder on children's developing mental health and their ability to use language to regulate their own emotions and behaviors. So that's very exciting. I think having that longitudinal perspective is rare, and it's really useful to know it, to knowing how language changes over time and what things facilitate language change. I think there's a lot more going on about the brain basis of language disorder, and that's been really interesting because, like I said, we used to think that it was just a problem with language, and now we have a much better understanding that it involves neural circuits in the brain that are involved in learning. So that gives you a whole different perspective, and I think can be really informative in terms of thinking about interventions. So if it's about neural circuits, could you just provide more of what typical children get to build those circuits? Or do you need to think about alternative ways of children learning the same information? And we're only at the very beginning of that. So I see that as a really exciting field. And of course, we have more and more good quality intervention studies all the time. So not only can we say, is this helpful, but we can say, who is this helpful for? How much do you need to make a change? And I think that will really transform our approach to services. And I think the other thing that is exciting, but really, again, at the very beginning, is a growing recognition of these co-occurring conditions. And I think working collaboratively with other professionals is really the way forward so that we can have integrated packages of care that will really address all of their needs rather than just working on language in isolation without thinking about how those changes in language will impact other aspects of the developmental system.
Right, so lots going on.
Yeah, definitely. It's hard to keep up with, but I find it endlessly fascinating.
You've produced this new guide for ACAM. Can you give a summary of some of the areas that are covered in this?
Yeah, so one of the things that we cover is about terminology. So we've been using the term DLD, but that's really quite a recent term. I think the field has been challenged for a long time by the fact that people have used different words to describe similar behaviors. So we would have developmental dysphasia, specific language impairment, primary language deficits. And that made it really quite confusing, difficult to compare different research studies, but also difficult to communicate between professional groups and to the public at large. Whereas in comparison, you have autism, which has been a term that people have used for 70 years now. And even though it describes quite a heterogeneous group of people, I think having one singular term has really helped to raise awareness in the general population and to get better services in place. So in the topic guide, I talk about why we had this change in terminology and the evidence behind it. And I think that's really important. It would be great if all professionals could start using DLD as the preferred term, so that there's consistency for parents and families and young people themselves. It's very useful for them to have a label that they can identify with and that they can use to explain to other people what they need to get the best communication going. I give people a little overview of different aspects of language and what that means. And then we talk a bit about co-occurring conditions, what we know about causes, how children are assessed and diagnosed, and some of the long-term outcomes for children with DLD.
Right. With just going back to the term DLD, when was it first introduced then?
So it is a term that has been around for a while, but again, it was one of many. So a few years ago, I started something called the Raising Awareness of Language Learning Impairments. With some colleagues. And one of the aims of that was to get some traction on this terminology issue. And one of the founding members of this group was Dorothy Bishop at Oxford. And to do that, she started an international consortium called Catalyze. And what we did was we tried to get input from speech and language therapists, psychologists, educators, and families, and really say, okay, here are all the terms that are currently in use. Here are the pros of some of these. Here are the cons of some of these. Can we come up with an agreement on what we want to call it? And through that process, we did a Delphi exercise. And through that process, the agreement was that we would use the term DLD. And that was launched in October of last year. So it's been a year, and the awareness is growing, and I think people are really getting behind the term DLD, and certainly recognize that it does make it easier to communicate and easier to raise awareness if we're using consistent terminology.
Right. So hopefully it will make a real difference.
I think it will. I think you can see it happening now, and that's really exciting.
Is there anything you want to add that I haven't asked you, perhaps a sort of take-home message for those listening to this podcast?
Well, I think the main take-home message is that if you're working in any kind of child service, education, health, CAMHS, you will meet children who have language disorders. And language is central to everything that we do. So if a child looks like they might have learning problems or behavior problems, really think, could language be playing a role here, and get it checked out? And although we can't cure language disorder, we certainly can teach children language, and we can teach them good strategies for having effective communication. And I really think communication is a human right. If you think about the language you've used today, you use it to engage with your partner, your children, your friends, for learning, for work, for leisure activities like reading and going to the cinema. So really, if you don't have good language, it impacts every aspect of your life. And therefore, finding ways that we can support children can only be a really good and positive thing for them and their families.
Brilliant. Courtney, thank you ever so much. You can find Professor Courtney Norbury's topic guide on language disorders on the ACAM website, that's www.acam.org, and on Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelt A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.